Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today continues our delving into the criminal law side of the appellate docket. It's Matthew Wright, who's an assistant federal public defender in the Northern District of Texas. Matthew, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you both for having me.
Matthew, tell us just kind of a little bit about yourself, maybe your background, so our listeners can know a little bit about you.
Sure. I grew up in East Texas, as far east as you can go, in Texarkana, which is sort of a city in two different states. I went to UT undergrad and the University of Arkansas for law school. I really have strong representation in both of those states. I grew up on the Texas side and was sort of firmly committed to that until law school. But I was baptized by a future governor of Arkansas. So I feel like I'm close to a native Arkansan as you can be without being one. After law school, I clerked for Judge Kenneth Hoyt in Houston as a U.S. district judge for a year. And then I went to Sidley Austin in D.C. for about a year. I had been two summers with them before. And after that, I joined the Federal Public Defender's Office in Amarillo, Texas, of all places. I assume most of your listeners are familiar with the size and scope of Texas, but Amarillo is about as far away from Texarkana as you can be. And yet it's still not even, you know, the distance, you know, to my dad lives in Corpus Christi now. It's even further there. So it's very different. It snows here. There's snow on the ground today. Very unlike the rest of Texas. Very windy, very Midwestern. They have pictures of Olympic wrestlers on the high school, you know, walls that my kids go to. The only wrestling that I knew was like Hulk Hogan growing up. So it's a very different climate. They ask you not where you went to school here, but where your grandpa went to school, because there's a lot of longtime panhandle families. But we have grown to love the place. And I have been here since 2008, minus 1 year that we were in Dallas. And I have been with the Federal Public Defender since 2008, minus 1 year when I was in private practice. Again, but they were not the same year. When I rejoined our office, it was in the Dallas office, and then I moved back to Amarillo.
So how did you go from Sidley in DC to the Federal Public Defender in Amarillo? That's quite a transition.
It is. A lot of people would say error, which is something I'm prone to fairly often. But the direct way was I'd clerked for Judge Hoyt and really got to love the federal criminal practice. At the time, was pressuring the defender in Houston, who's named Margie Myers. I love Margie, but she says, you don't speak Spanish, so, you know, take a hike. I was like, no, really, you should hire me. And I was just like, you don't speak Spanish, take a hike. So I went back to Sidley, and the firm there has a really strong pro bono practice. And one of the things that they did that I really liked was we would help moot federal public defender attorneys and CJA attorneys. That's CJA are people who are in private practice but take appointed cases in federal court who had arguments at the Supreme Court. And so I would volunteer for every one of those, you know, on a criminal law issue because I was interested in it. And in 2007, my former colleague, Jerry Beard, was mooting a case called Cuellar versus the United States. I met a lot of my current colleagues then, said, hey, guys, you know, I'm from Texas. I'd love to get back to Texas, but I don't speak Spanish. And I'm in the Northern District of Texas. We don't speak Spanish either. You know, so the appellate section has a little bit of benefit in that regard. And so a position opened up here in Amarillo. They told me, you know, it's kind of a different place, Amarillo, but just come there for a year or two and then we'll move you to the big city. And that was 13, 14 years ago. We're still waiting.
So you're with the appellate section in the public defender's office out there?
Right. So the Northern District of Texas is the big cities where we have staffed offices are in Dallas, Fort Worth, Lubbock, and Amarillo. There are sort of magistrate judge courthouses in Abilene, San Angelo, Wichita Falls, but we don't have offices there. And our appellate section takes cases from all of the divisions. So my cases could come from anywhere, but sometimes you just need a person here either to go into court to help. At the time I came to the Amarillo office, there was only one other attorney here. So some of it was just running over and helping with a bail hearing every now and again, not nearly as often as they told me it would be when they got me convinced me to move from DC. So our office is, the big division is between what they call the traditional unit and the capital habeas unit. They do really good work, but they're still newfangled to me, and all of the law students want to work on death penalty cases. So we have this joking rivalry with them over talent, you know. So we won't talk about the capital habeas unit. And then within the traditional unit, we're further divided into appeals and trial. Trial meaning, you know, district court proceedings, and then appeals. We primarily handle direct appeals from federal convictions and sentences. And we also handle all of the non-capital post-conviction matters that very occasionally involves a state prisoner who's filed a federal habeas action, but only if they get an evidentiary hearing. It also involves federal prisoners filing post-conviction actions. We did not do much of that at all until 2016. And since 2016, it feels like it's all that I do is federal post-conviction actions. But that's sort of the division of our office and what my role is here.
So the Federal Public Defender's Office is kind of a nationwide program, but you geographically are divided similar to like the U.S. Attorney's offices. Is that
sort of, yes,
somewhat accurate?
It is somewhat accurate. We are part of the judicial branch, so we're not part of the executive, and we do not have the hierarchy that the Department of Justice does. So each of the U.S. attorneys is appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, but ultimately answers to the Attorney General. Whereas the Federal Public Defender offices, we can't even agree on, you know, when it's time for a coffee break. So, you know, my boss is Jason Hawkins. He's appointed by the Fifth Circuit and he answers to them. And there's a branch of the administrative office of the U.S. courts that sort of oversees everything. But we are an independent organization for our district and we're federal employees. But yeah, the structure is the same in that my office is specific to this federal district.
But of course, being where we are in Texas and sitting within the Fifth Circuit, all of your appeals are going to the Fifth Circuit. That seems self-evident, but it's probably worth confirming.
That's correct. So any appeal from a federal district court in Texas would go first to the Fifth Circuit. And if it goes beyond that, it would be to the U.S. Supreme Court. There are almost no occasions for us to show up in another circuit. I have, on one occasion that I can think of, appeared in the Western District of Texas for what they called an ancillary proceeding to one of our cases. But it's incredibly governmental and bureaucratic for us to do that. So for the most part, it is the courts of the Northern District of Texas, the Fifth Circuit, or the Supreme Court for me.
And so you're being distributed out in the High Plains. It really doesn't make much difference to your practice, it doesn't sound like, because you're appealing to the same court that your counterpart in, say, the Dallas office would be. And it's just a matter of where you office and where you live.
That's really true. It could be anywhere. You could do it remotely, even not from our district, if you were so inclined. There are some rules about that, I think. But in general, physical location is, like I say, where you are if you need to run into district court. And my cases, as I say, can come from any of the divisions, because on a direct appeal, your record is more or less fixed before you get involved in the case. And so, you know, it's just a set of documents that could be from anywhere. But yeah, that's right. The physical location is mostly, you know, which district court I would be more likely to run over into, or, you know, who can come knock on your door versus who has to call or email for help.
Right. You've given us some sense, too, of the size of the district by virtue of the fact that we're talking about Dallas and Amarillo in the same sentence, being both within the Northern District. Geographically, is that the biggest district in the state?
I mean, I'd have to get somebody to fact check me on that, on who has more square footage and who has longer drive. We have incredibly long drives to some of the outlying locations. There is divisional venue in criminal cases in a way that is, you know, mostly eliminated for civil purposes. So our jury panel, for instance, will be drawn from the Amarillo division. I do think our division within the district is bigger than any of the others. But if you look at the map of the federal judicial districts of Texas, it looks incredibly gerrymandered and it's hard to understand. For instance, there are points in my district, the Northern District, that are south of points in the Southern District and points that are east of the Eastern District and so on. You think Abilene and San Angelo are in my district, but Midland and Odessa are in the Western District, and that doesn't make any sense. And Beaumont is in the Eastern District, you know, whereas Houston is the Southern District. I have actually tried, and one day we'll publish an article on the reason that we got our shapes, how the federal judicial districts got their shapes. It's kind of a historical accident, I think, but I'm not very attentive to that project because I do have a very busy caseload, but it's very weird is what I'm saying. If you look at the map, you just have to know by heart which major cities are in which districts. And even then, some cities like Plano are actually in two federal judicial districts. So we actually tried an appeal one time to say, well, you didn't prove venue because they only said it was in Plano. And that all Plano is probably in the Eastern District. Arlington has a piece of it that's in the Eastern District because the federal districts are defined by county in Texas. And so you have to know what county things took place before you know whether you were in the right district or not.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Interesting. One of those little nuances you don't necessarily think about as a civil attorney in Texas.
Right.
This is probably kind of a basic question, but I mean, how does your office get its cases?
So we are organized under the Criminal Justice Act, which is a federal statute. We represent people who are indigent. So we like to say we are the best representation that money can't buy. Or at least we hope to provide that. So if someone is prosecuted for a federal criminal case, so typically by the United States Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Texas, occasionally by one of the main justice components, when they're arrested or when they get a target letter from the grand jury, they fill out a financial affidavit. And if they are deemed eligible for appointed counsel, then someone will be appointed. We are the default for appointment in this district. Then for various reasons, whether because there's multiple defendants or because we have a conflict or just because they're tired of us and they convince the court that we should be fired and that they should get another lawyer, then the court will go to the CJA panel. The panels are all organized according to the divisional office. So the Dallas and Fort Worth have a very formal panel where there's like a waiting list and like almost an apprenticeship situation that's supposed to be set up and people clamoring to get cases and get on the panel there. Whereas, you know, out here in Amarillo for a long time, we were like knocking on people's doors. We need people to help. And actually the previous district judge here believed that it was part of being a federal attorney that you took these appointed cases, you know, every member of the bar, which is a kind of a noble if quaint notion. So what it meant was, if you were a member of the federal bar here who did insurance defense or, you know, anything like that, you would get a call from the magistrate judge about once every 3 or 4 years and say, well, Jody, your number's up again, you know, and your first call then would be to me, right? The person conflicted out of representing your client saying, oh no, what do I do? But we have moved over the last few years into something more like the panel system that the other divisions have. People at least volunteer for the work, or they're voluntold, depending on what office they're in.
So if you're in a case with multiple defendants, your office can only represent one in any particular case?
Right.
And then what about appeals? Do those typically come from your office, or do you get some from outside too?
We do have what we call cold record appeals, which are from outside the office. Under the Criminal Justice Act, whether you're appointed from the panel or the federal public defender, the statutory default is that you are on the case all the way through the U.S. Supreme Court. And as a matter of black letter law, that's what you should expect. Having said that, most of the attorneys on our panels in the cities prefer district court representation. That's why they're involved in it. As the practice gets more and more specialized, you find attorneys who don't really want to appeal. On the other hand, there are also people who want to be on the panel but want to do only appeals. For instance, if someone didn't live in our district, they can get on some of the panels and could take appeals. And as you pointed out earlier, you could do my job from anywhere as long as you had internet access and a quiet place to work. And so it makes sense, in my view, to have a separation there. And in some cases, we do. But so I would say the bulk of our appeals are cases that we had in district court. We also have, there are cases where the original attorney in trial court has to get off of the case or chooses to get off the case and the court lets them and there is no conflict. And so we are appointed. And so we get cases that way. And then in post-conviction cases, there will almost always be a conflict between all of the earlier attorneys and the post-conviction attorney because one of the primary claims you would raise is ineffective assistance of trial counsel or appellate counsel. And I am more than willing to raise that claim against myself, but I guess the court said, don't think that's very common. So our post-conviction cases would be, in general, someone that we had not represented in any way prior.
Is there a right to counsel in post-conviction?
There is not. And in the vast majority of cases, even a motion requesting the appointment of counsel, at least in our district, they're denied. The two exceptions to that are if there is going to be an evidentiary hearing, I think they have to appoint counsel for that, or at least you would have to get special permission to do an evidentiary hearing as a pro se litigant. So whenever an evidentiary hearing is ordered, that was where we would historically get appointed on post-conviction cases. And typically, not only is the record set in stone there, but all the claims have already been litigated and you get one tiny little piece of the case appointed. But the Criminal Justice Act allows for appointment of counsel for post-conviction cases. And I mentioned that I had done a lot of these cases since 2015, 2016. There was a decision, kind of a lightning bolt watershed decision from the Supreme Court in 2015 called Johnson versus United States. It declared a part of the Armed Career Criminal Act unconstitutional. I'm happy to say more about that if you want. It wouldn't bore you to tears. There was a decision the following year called Welch versus United States that declared that the new rule in Johnson was retroactive. And because Johnson was such a special kind of rule, something like a once in a career sort of rule from the Supreme Court, all of the normal limitations of post-conviction review were kind of out the window, so that normally you only have 1 year after your direct appeal is finished to file what's called a 2255. Well, there's an exception for that where there's a new rule like Johnson. You have 1 year from that. So we had 1 year from Johnson to file all of those claims. And so hundreds of cases, and we were just trying as best we could to figure out who might be eligible. We had not, obviously no one had coded these cases for what might happen if the Supreme Court strikes down just a part of this law later. I was looking right before we turned on the podcast. I don't have the exact number. I really should. But we were appointed initially on at least 173 Johnson post-conviction cases. Then there were these decisions that there was a circuit splits over how far Johnson would go. Okay, so this applies to the Armed Career Criminal Act, but does it apply to Section 16? Does it apply to 924C? So then there were two other decisions from the Supreme Court that said, yes, Johnson does apply to that. One of those was Sessions versus DiMaia, which is an immigration case, but we defend a lot of immigration crimes. And then there was a case called Davis versus United States, which I know very well because our office's case, my colleague Brandon Beck, argued that at the U.S. Supreme Court. And so then there was a statute called 924C. Also, same rule applies under 924C. So then there are Davis 2255s. And it feels extremely hilarious and foolish now in hindsight. But there was a point in 2016 where I said to my bosses, I have some experience doing civil litigation from private practice and I clerked for a judge. We're really just waiting on a couple of decisions about Texas prior convictions. And all these cases will be resolved either all the same way. They'll all win or they'll all lose. Why don't you let me formally enter my appearance in all these cases? You take all of my direct appeals and 6 or 7 weeks from now, you know, we'll have these resolved and I can go back to normal. And as I say, that was in 2016. Like, it turned out to be bonkers and insane. Part of that is because we are tenacious as defenders. And you say, we just need an answer on this question. And the Fifth Circuit will say, okay, here's your answer. No. And we'll say, no, we wanted a yes. You know, that's not the answer we wanted. And so other cases came out of that. Honestly, every week we have to just call a supervisor like, okay, hey, what does the Johnson load like? Are we ready to go back to normal yet? And I'm like, I'm sure it'll be next week. You know, next meeting, we'll have them done, right? No. I probably have about, 30 or 40 cases at varying stages of stay that are still alive, that haven't been lost yet. Every one of them should win. I keep telling the judges, if you would just let us win, you can make it go away. Unfortunately, the government also has a right to appeal, and which they're willing to exercise in certain circumstances. And so that assurance too has turned out to be false. Even when they let us win, it's not necessarily the case is over.
Wow. That's crazy that so much of that has changed in just such a short time. Well, it probably doesn't feel like a short time to you anymore now, you know, almost 6 years down the road.
Yeah. Changed the course of your career, it seems like. I mean, that's quite an investment of time to spend working on that stuff. So the CJA panels, I wanted to ask a follow-up about that. I understand that they're private attorneys and they get on the list, whether it's the voluntold or they're actually volunteering. I take it you see that with these being panels, you might tend to see the same lawyers over and over again on the panels. Is that right?
It depends on the division. The panels in Dallas and Fort Worth are very large. Even so, I think there's an understanding of the magistrate judges who are typically doing the appointment of who wants more cases. And other people, I mean, you can't turn down cases over and over again and stay on the panel. But there are some people, kind of the elder statesmen and women of the panel, right, who aren't wanting the cases except when they're needed. And so there are some who you see less often. But yes.
I was curious about whether that might be, you know, for someone who's starting up their own practice in criminal defense, if they wanted to focus on federal defense practice, that would be it seems like a good way to supplement their practice or start their practice.
I think that part of our mission is to help educate and train the CJA panel. We take calls from them. I have to do timesheets at the end of every month. They're much simpler than I had to do in private practice. Still, I find it to be a chore and a pain and something I'm horrible at. And if my bosses are listening to this, they'll say, he doesn't ever do his timesheet on time anyway. But we have an entry on our timesheet for not case-related panel. And it's for helping someone through a difficult case or doing bigger training. Every year, our Dallas office puts on a big CLE that is typically no cost for people who are on the panel. And that's a two-day annual seminar to try to have a day before that for the people like you mentioned, who maybe have experience doing state criminal work, but are interested in federal work, to try to bring them up to speed. As we were standing up a panel of people in Amarillo, we did the same thing. We did a series of like six CLE sessions to try to get people ready for it. Having said that, I would not want my first criminal case to be a federal CJA appointment unless I had someone I could sort of shadow to walk me through it. There's some eccentricities to federal practice and specific pitfalls. In some ways, it's very similar to what I would say is criminal practice in state court. In other ways, it's very, very different. And some of those ways that federal practice is different is actually more suited to somebody who's maybe done civil litigation practice, because research and contested hearings that you might not get if you were sort of new in state court practice.
One of the things you had mentioned to me when we were kind of exchanging ideas was that every criminal case in federal court has a contested sentencing. So even if they plead guilty, there's still appellate issues that arise from that.
Absolutely. So I have never practiced in Texas state court as a criminal defense attorney, but I have a lot of friends who do, and I have to read a lot of Texas criminal appellate decisions as part of my practice. So almost every one of those cases, when a case is resolved by a plea agreement or a guilty plea, it will have a sentence that's either recommended or agreed upon by the parties. And so at the time that the guilt or innocence is established, which is typically by a plea statistically, so is the sentence. And so that's sort of the agreement. And I don't know, maybe this isn't fair because again, I haven't ever done it. My impression is that those numbers are kind of a market-based, drawn from thin air system. You know, what's the going rate for a third DWI? You know, or so, I don't know. But federal court is not like that. So if someone is convicted either by bench trial or jury trial or by a guilty plea, which again, statistically is much more common, there is a separate and contested sentencing hearing. And there are multiple lines of law, statutory law, guidelines in federal court, judicial constitutional law that govern what happens at sentencing. And each of those things could hypothetically give rise to an appeal of the sentence. So every federal criminal case could potentially give rise to an appeal. That's one of those things I mentioned. It's very different than someone who's not done this would experience.
I guess frequently or infrequently, are there jury trials in the Northern District? Is it something that happens very often or not really?
They are not common nationwide in both federal and state courts. The numbers run 95% and above cases that are resolved by plea or, you know, agreement of the parties. Of course, not everyone who's charged is convicted, but a lot of times prosecutors will dismiss a case. You know, I'm not counting that in, but people who are convicted, it's upwards 95% and above everywhere. The federal system has some extreme penalties that are available for very commonly prosecuted crimes. And it is typically only the good graces of the prosecutor that keep you from being exposed to those. So in federal court, there are a lot of incentives to resolve the plea rather than trial. And so that's not to say that we don't try cases. We do. I have personally participated as second chair in two jury trials in the time that I've been here in Amarillo. I regret both of those. It's not my favorite thing. I'm not one of those people who says, oh, I just live for trial, you know, and that feeling of being so alive and every one of your senses is tingling. Yes, all that is true. I hate that. It's terrible. You know, I would much rather have a month with the cold record to read through things and then call up your trial attorney colleague and say, "Wow, I can't believe you didn't raise this so-and-so argument." Of course, when you're there, you're thinking of none of those things, right? So we have had jury trials in Amarillo that I was not involved in, as second chair. So, and some of the panel attorneys have had jury trials too, but it's uncommon. It's extremely uncommon to see a jury trial. If we're just talking about, you know, the run of the mill, the vast majority of cases that we would handle are going to be resolved at dismissal or a guilty plea.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as court surety bond agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. So there's a guilty plea entered, but we're still talking about the court then being responsible for assigning punishment. And that's where, I guess, the sentencing guidelines come into play. Is that part of the negotiation, though, is what we're going to plead to X crime because the defendant would know and the public defender and the prosecutor would all know what the range of punishment would be essentially for that crime? Or it seems like there may be more data points than that because you've got to consider recidivism and things like that, if I'm understanding any of this correctly.
Well, I'm happy to talk to you until you're blue in the face. Not until I'm blue in the face, because I could keep going. But until you're blue in the face, I could talk to you about federal sentencing law. But broad outlines, most of the crimes that Congress has created have incredibly large punishment ranges. So the default punishment for possession of a controlled substance with intent to deliver, just one of the more commonly prosecuted crimes in federal court, is between 0 years and 20 years in prison. And then based on the quantities that the person is found to have distributed, the statutory ranges, they can go up to 5 years to 40 years or 10 years to life. So you can imagine that your attorney comes to you and says, you're facing a punishment range of 10 years to life. So the impression was that there were regional differences, you know, judge by judge differences, just sort of a lot of unfairness. And some really well-meaning people came up with this federal sentencing guideline system, which I sort of jokingly refer to as like a suffering computer, you know, and the two inputs that you put into the computer are what you did this time and what you've been convicted of before. So that's the recidivism thing versus what you did now. And it plots it on a chart and it spits out a certain amount of suffering that you have to do to bring you even with the house, so to speak. So at the back of the Federal Sentencing Guidelines Manual, there is a graph, basically. And, you know, the horizontal axis is criminal history category. And there are all of these mathematical rules about calculating which of these categories you will fall into. I have compared it to the old-fashioned scale at the doctor's office. You know, there's like 50-pound thing that a chunker moving over. And the nurse is always grabbing that. And I'm like, no, ma'am, you need to work on that one column a little more. She's like, no, we're going to, you know, that's sort of how it is. You do all this complicated math. That's like the tiny slider. And then as you move the chunker up, that moves you to the column that you're in on this chart. And then there's offense levels that go from like 0 to 43. And that is based on the current crime, generally, what you did here. That goes up and then just match it up in the chart. And you come up with a range of like 96 to 113 months. That's sort of what we'll say in the box. And that's a little more specific than 10 years to life. But as you point out, if you had pleaded guilty to 10 years to life, well, that's 120 months. And so your guideline range then kind of becomes the statutory minimum. And in that sense, one of the things that a competent federal criminal defense attorney is doing is trying to calculate what the sentencing guidelines will be in the case, and then negotiating a plea to the extent it's possible to either limit someone's exposure or to put them in the best possible position as far as the guidelines. Well, I think 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court said, yes, this federal sentencing guideline system is all well and good, but it's kind of unconstitutional. Because, you know, the tiny little thing, the jury doesn't have an adequate role in making the determinations. And so they should have struck down the sentencing guideline system and thrown it out. But the guidelines turned out to be sort of lucky in that one of the creators of the guidelines happened to be sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court. And he happened to persuade one of the justices who was on the substantive majority to change sides on the remedial opinion. And the Supreme Court has rendered this guideline system advisory. So you have this entirely complex and non-intuitive system of suffering math that you do for the machine, and it will spit out this very specific range of punishment. And then the judge has to do that correctly, but then the judge can say, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to throw that out and give you something else, right? Based on these other statutory factors. So it is a discretionary system, but there is a mandatory computation under the sentencing guidelines. So just by the way I describe this, you can kind of imagine how occasionally an appellate issue or two might pop up in doing this. So I do often think of myself not just as a federal criminal lawyer or an appellate lawyer. I'm a sentencing lawyer. It's not that I don't do issues that were related to convictions. I do. But the vast majority of my work has been on federal sentencing issues. Not only that, but partly because of my role in this Johnson litigation, ill-considered though it might be, and partly because of just the consequences that are attached to having certain prior convictions, various versions of three strikes laws federally. I'm a prior conviction sentencing lawyer. The vast majority of my work is arguing over whether or not, for instance, a Texas burglary crime counts as a strike, if you will, a violent felony or a crime of violence or something like that. These rules turn out to be exceedingly complex. The Byzantine monks who argued over how many angels could dance on the head of a pin would never think of designing a system complicated as deciding whether or not Texas burglary is a violent felony for purposes of the Armed Career Criminal Act. And that will affect whether or not it is also a crime of violence for purposes of a related guideline provision that is similar but not the same. And you see, the consequences are extremely high. It's extremely unintuitive. And so that's sort of most of what I do. It has to do with analysis, not of the convictions, the crimes that someone did today, you know, that they're on trial for or that they pleaded guilty to, though that certainly comes into it. A lot of it has to do with how do we characterize or classify the previous crime, which is treated not just as something that moves the chunker up on the guideline axis for criminal history. Normally, once you do that, it doesn't matter what your prior conviction was, so as long as just how many points are assigned to it and you move it up. But then you have these special rules that apply that will come in and just knock it way high. So I mentioned the Armed Career Criminal Act earlier. That's what the Johnson case was about. The federal crime of felon in possession of a firearm ordinarily carries a punishment range of 0 to 10 years. Now, that seems very, very large range to me. It's very difficult to make an intelligent decision of whether or not you want to risk somewhere between probation and 10 years in prison at the time you're deciding whether to go to trial or not. But if the Armed Career Criminal Act applies, the mandatory minimum punishment is 15 years and the maximum is life. And so the distinction is huge, right? And so I know that judges get very frustrated in what they consider sort of arcane distinctions between burglaries that can be committed against a houseboat versus burglaries that could only be committed against a speedboat or fishing boat, but not a houseboat. But those distinctions can make a huge difference in the lives of my clients. So this is how we get into this lifestyle.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about that because those of us on the civil side, a lot of it, our exposure to criminal law comes from criminal procedure in law school and the bar, which is focused on, of course, you know, all the big criminal law greatest hits from the Supreme Court. But you just don't see this side of it, even though that's primarily all you've done for the last 6 years. And then on top of that,
I don't mean to undersell those kind of classic criminal procedure issues. My colleague, Brandon Beck, who argued the Davis case at the Supreme Court, also has an en banc case pending right now on a Fourth Amendment issue. It's really kind of interesting. It's kind of an unexpected permutation of those issues. So we have those all the time. And that comes into play during plea negotiations. Pretrial motions typically have to be filed before a plea is negotiated. So you have to kind of guess where things are going in those areas too. But it so happens that both because of the eccentric way that federal sentencing is built, Rube Goldberg machine that it is, and because these are areas where you can get appellate relief because they're purely questions of law, it just so happens that the incentive structure has made this my job.
I think I actually may be more confused now than before we started. Because I, you know, you think about plea deals as you're gaining certainty. That's the benefit. And gosh, there's just a lot of moving parts to the federal system from what you said.
You remember before I was trying to encourage people to join their local CJA panel. Absolutely. We want you on the panel. We will help you walk through it. But also, like, you could be advising someone that they're looking at probation and then they plead guilty and then, you know, they're looking at 10 years now and you say, oh my gosh, you told me probation. And the probation office is saying, well, you're lucky you took the plea to the 10-year cap because otherwise it would be 20. And so, unfortunately, you could not learn on the job because you have to know what's going to happen at sentencing and potentially on appeal at the time you're advising somebody whether or not they want to file this pretrial motion, which is going to make the prosecutor mad and potentially file these other enhancements against you. So I agree with you. It's very frustrating to not know that. Now, there are cases, certain kinds of crimes where the guidelines are just extremely high. And in our district, the guidelines are still very, very influential. Really, what we have under the post-Booker advisory guideline regime is a return to the olden days of geographic distinctions in terms of how severe they are, judge-by-judge distinctions, right? We've just gone back to that. So it's just more work for the rest of us, you might say. But in our district, the judges do tend to hold pretty close to the guidelines as a starting point. So if the guidelines are a million years and you're debating with the prosecutor whether the prosecutor will agree to a five-year, a charge that carries a five-year maximum versus a 10-year maximum, there's some certainty in that case. You're going to get 5 years or you're going to get 10 years. You can ask for less, but realistically, we can say you're going to get that. In the same way, a mandatory minimum, of which there are plenty in federal sentencing practice, you can be pretty sure you're going to get the minimum. Absent a few escape hatches from that, you're going to be stuck with that. I did mention that every federal sentencing could give rise to an appeal. Since you mentioned certainty, I'll get on my soapbox here for a second. Current Fifth Circuit law and every other circuit allows a defendant to waive her right to appeal the sentence that hasn't happened yet. So the errors that you don't even know are going to happen, you can waive your right to appeal. Now, if you were going to ask me how that makes sense from a knowing and intelligent and voluntary, well, it doesn't, but I'm just telling you that's the rules. You have to know the rules. So this plays into it too. You have to have an assessment of what the likely sentencing issues are and whether or not they might be of the sort that could give rise to relief on appeal, in which case you then have to advise your client, okay, they're offering this deal. You know, you're charged with two counts. The conduct necessary to prove one count will establish the other one. They're going to allow you to plead to one, but you're going to have to give up your right to appeal the errors that the judge hasn't made yet. Unfortunate and frustrating conversation to have, but this is why they hire appellate lawyers, right? To try to figure some of this out, and we have these conversations. It's only every defendant who's prosecuted in federal court where this comes up, though. So it's not like it's something that happens all the time.
I see why the CJA lawyers are burning up the phone lines. If I were on a panel, I sure would be, because I would definitely want all the advice and expertise I could tap into something like that. Are there any CJA lawyers that get to work on post-conviction matters, or is that strictly your office?
No, there are. And again, it's district by district, but if that was something that someone wanted to do, they could tell the magistrate judge that, because for the most part, people on the panel hate those cases, right? And in the pre-Johnson days, where my only work was on evidentiary hearings, like, I kind of hated to get one of those too, to be honest. Listen, I loved the clients. They all turned out to be great, wonderful people. I'm glad that I met them. And they should have won even where we lost. But I hated the cases, because the only thing you would get an evidentiary hearing on was whether or not the defendant had told her attorney to file a notice of appeal or not, because she didn't file a notice of appeal. And if she said file a notice of appeal and she didn't, that's ineffective assistance. And what you get is an out-of-time appeal. Sometimes, being an appellate lawyer, I know that all you're going to get out of that is what's called an Anders brief, which is where the appellate attorney says, listen, I've done my best. I can't find anything to even plausibly raise. It's sort of like, you've seen the junk I'm willing to file over my signature. I can't even find anything that good. Okay, even I can't find it, right? But I submit it to you, court. And if you were able to identify an issue, I dare you to find something I haven't thought about. Send it back to me and I'll brief it. Otherwise, that's an Anders brief, an Anders versus California motion to withdraw. So I'm having to ruin somebody's day, probably somebody I talked into joining the panel 5 years ago. You know what I'm saying? Now I get to come in and say, are you sure she didn't tell you to file that appeal, right? And it's like, all you're going to get out of that is a losing appeal, especially if there's an appeal waiver. Now, imagine that, as occasionally happens, there's some kind of devastating legal error in the proceedings, you know, like the very rare sort of get out of jail free card or something like that, that they forgot to play. It was right there in your hand. That's a little bit of exaggeration, but it could happen, right? Now you've got, okay, here's an error, substantive error, my client is entitled to relief on. I have to try to find a way to sneak that error into these proceedings so that this isn't just a Pyrrhic victory in getting, you know, an Anders brief to file. So no, I hated those cases. So if anybody out there listening would like to be appointed to only post-conviction evidentiary hearing matters, you call me, because I will be sure that my cases are all referred to you. I will find a conflict of interest and I will get that case.
All right. I want to follow up on something else you said, which was, you see post-conviction challenges based on ineffective assistance in the trial court. You specifically said appellate as well. So I guess people get to be unhappy with their appellate lawyer. They feel like they should have gotten some relief. Their appellate lawyer did a bad job. How does that work? What are the prospects for an appellant to get any relief in that circumstance?
So it's going to depend a lot on the legal issues that are involved. There's a lot of circuit level law that says we don't have to be clairvoyant in the sense of you don't have to anticipate changes in the law, but you do have to research the issues. I have raised ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claims before. You talk about cannibalism, right? I mean, this is like sort of like, don't ask me if I ever did this because, you know, but for each client, we take each client individually and do the best we can. Like, say there's like a decent appellate claim in there and the person hasn't researched at all, hasn't looked into that at all, or has pursued a strategy instead that is like not going anywhere. Imagine you have a claim that you could raise. There are a few claims that will survive an appellate waiver, plea agreement. So maybe that claim was there, but the attorney didn't know about it, or didn't look for it, didn't think about it, but instead raised something that plainly was covered by the waiver. And that might be an example of where they give rise to it. A lot of times, ineffective assistance of appellate counsel has to do with things that were also, like, it's against both of them. If it's the same person, you know, you messed up not raising it, and then you messed up not raising it again on, like, plain error, because you can raise some claims on appeal that you didn't raise in district court. Or if it's two different people, it's like, really, is what I'd like to say. Todd, it's really Jody who messed up. We're going after Jody. We're going after him hard, okay? Nobody's going to say the name Jody Sanders after this case is over, but I got to put you in it, too. Normally, I talk to the people because they have to give me their file. And I don't know, that's only been the law in Texas for like 50 years and like 100 Supreme Court of Texas cases about it, attorney general opinions. Somehow these state practitioners don't know that. So it's always a fight to get the file. And so that's when I talk to the people usually and it's sort of like, he said this and he said that. So, but yeah, I'll tell you another thing. I had a situation that's come up twice, maybe more than twice. I can think of two immediately where I'm working on these Johnson Armed Career Criminal Act case enhancements. And I have recognized that my office failed to notice a problem in the Armed Career Criminal Act sentence, independent of Johnson error. We have a lot of fights in the Johnson litigation about whether this is really a Johnson claim or is it actually under something else and whatever. Like I said, I could talk your ear off about that. But I'm talking about like, okay, this is like strikes one and two we're fighting about, but it turns out strike three wasn't a strike at all. Nobody would have thought so. If somebody had realized it, it'd be bad. And so on one occasion, I had to do that where it was me because this was like a recent case. It was like, I caught it at the cert petition stage, absolutely not pressed or passed upon in the Court of Appeals. And it was like, in re mea culpa was the cert petition sort of. In that case, the Solicitor General's office and the U.S. Attorney's office, very graciously, I thought, agreed not to raise procedural default, allowed us to raise it in 2255 so that we were able to stay on the case. And I was able to fix it. Thank goodness we could. And our guy ended up without the Armed Career Criminal Act sentence. They're good people over there. And the other one was one, it was like our office, but it was like from a long time ago. And it was like one of my bosses. It was like, you talk about an awkward phone call. I'm going to file some kind of common law writ. But, you know, and it was just like, you can see how somebody would miss it, but it was just there. It's fine. So that's the kind of thing that keeps you up at night, though, right? You're terrified of missing something like that. You know, drives you to just go deep in all of these cases. Spend a lot of time chasing down rabbit trails, as we say in East Texas, that don't end up not leading anywhere. But you just don't want to do that if you can help it.
Yeah. And we on the civil side, present company accepted, of course, mistakes are made. You like that use of the passive voice, by the way?
The honorative tense, right?
But when that happens, typically it's mostly money at issue, and it's not somebody's freedom or the difference between a 10-year or a 20-year sentence in the federal penitentiary. So that really is, I can see how that would keep someone in your position at night because you are talking about the difference between years on somebody's life. That's a very significant issue, especially no more experience than I am in criminal law matters wouldn't want to touch.
Although you've made the sentencing guidelines sound so simple. I mean, it just seems like I don't see where there's room for error there. I can't imagine.
It's a matter of rolling a dice, you know. With experience, I'd like to think that we learn to spot things. More than that, with experience, you get a sense for when you need to ask for help. And I think that's the most important thing, right? Is that I will have used this against me in a post-conviction proceeding. Okay, if I was on the appeal, I'm not really solid on the dumb rules about when you're post-arrest, pre-custody, silence, and whether or not you invoke it. All this Fifth Amendment junk, right? I will absolutely call somebody and say, okay, this is sort of like decision tree to decide whether or not this is a claim. Of course, we're going to raise it if we're filing the motion anyway, but is this a foreclosed claim? Is it a good claim? So you have to have a sense for where you're sort of soft, you know, on your knowledge and who would know about it. And I call people, it's not like everybody just calls me, right? I say, I get really into these prior conviction enhancements. People will call me about those. I will call about some of these other issues. Now, if you have time, if your docket allows, you can do the research from scratch. That's a lot of what we do, right? Is just trying to find something that we could raise and trying to figure it out. But the busier you are, or if you're someone who doesn't do this specific area of law all the time, you've got to know when to reach out for help.
So one of the kind of unique things about the criminal law side of things is you get to see more en bancs of the Fifth Circuit than I think civil practitioners could ever imagine.
I think that's true. You know, the Fifth Circuit's internal rules or practitioner's guide say that a petition for rehearing en banc is the most abused prerogative. And by that criterion alone, some people might call me in a long-term abusive relationship with the Fifth Circuit. I have had the pleasure of appearing twice for oral argument in front of the en banc court. One of those was a win, one of those was a loss, but they later took the win away in a written en banc opinion that was not accompanied by argument. I've had a couple of those as well. I'll also point out that I currently have a rehearing en banc petition pending at the Fifth Circuit, and I was really deeply involved in an amicus brief on somebody else's en banc case, to say nothing of my colleagues arguing as well. In our circuit, there is what the circuit calls the rule of orderliness. If anyone who's practiced primarily in front of the Fifth Circuit will be familiar with that phrase, basically what it means is stare decisis on steroids. The court has said repeatedly, even if we disagree with a prior published panel decision, we are bound by it. And so you can occasionally find a situation where there's an older panel decision that sets the law that maybe a newer panel overlooked or didn't see. More common is a situation where there is a panel decision that kind of distinguishes the previous decision in a way that maybe doesn't work, or what do you do when another case comes along and the distinction doesn't apply? And in all of those areas, I think it's just a matter of kind of maintaining uniformity of the court's precedent. I tend to think of the en banc process the way a lot of attorneys think about cert practice. And that is, it's not just error correction. It's about trying to maintain a uniform precedent to govern these three states and these scores or hundreds of appeals that they decide on these issues that tend to recur over and over again.
And then also Supreme Court practice is something that you probably do far more than the average appellate practitioner.
I think that's right. Every year, the Supreme Court takes one or more cases about substantive criminal law, in addition to the constitutional procedure issues that you mentioned that would be common to state court practice. Well, all of our statutes are also federal. So there's sort of got two ways that we can get a case in front of the Supreme Court. Then you have these prior conviction issues I mentioned before, which are just so complicated that the courts are continually getting tangled up in trying to sort through some of these difficult issues. My office, as I say, we had the Cuellar case, which I was not in the office, but that is how they sort of roped me into this business in 2007. That was not our first Supreme Court argument, and it wasn't our last. I have participated as second chair in two merits cases at the Supreme Court. One of those is a case called Setzer versus United States that only an appellate lawyer could love, and that is whether a federal district court judge has the authority to order the sentence that she is imposing to run consecutively or concurrently with a state court sentence that is not yet imposed. So I think when we let you go, Dallas County is going to go forward with those burglary charges. I don't know what's going to happen, but if you get a sentence, I either want that time to count against my sentence or I don't want it to count against my sentence. The Supreme Court, incorrectly in my view, ruled that the answer is yes, that the judge does have that authority. So we lost that case, Setzer versus United States. And some years later, I helped my good friend and colleague Brandon, along with another really incredible team, argue in Davis versus United States that the residual clause definition of crime of violence in 18 U.S.C. section 924C was unconstitutionally vague for the same reason that earlier residual clauses in section 16B and in the Armed Career Criminal Act were unconstitutionally vague, and the Supreme Court agreed with us. They said yes. So I'm one in one up there. I'll also say that I have sort of jokingly called myself like the Susan Lucci of cert practice in federal criminal practice, because I have been the relist watch more times than I could count. I mean, I used to keep a count, but it made me too bitter. I mean, I've been almost the one so many times. So much so that now I'm just quite sure that one of the criteria for cert worthiness is not me as counsel of record.
Always the amicus, but never the petitioner.
Right. So that is one of the things that attracted me to this practice in the beginning. And that's one of the things that's unique about the federal public defender as compared to the Department of Justice. Because while the appellate U.S. attorneys are consulted on Supreme Court cases, the Office of Solicitor General is going to come in and just sort of take over. And there's a criminal appellate section of Maine Justice, really great attorneys. One of my best friends works there, but they are going to be working at it at the cert stage. So they will let a sap-headed redneck from East Texas write a cert petition, and it will get at least on the relist watch on SCOTUS blog, if not a merits grant. That's one of the cool things about my job. That's one of the things that sort of keeps you going when you're otherwise disappointed in it. You know, you lose bad enough in my business, and maybe you get yourself a marriage grant.
Well, this has all been enlightening. We are near the end of our time that we had scheduled to be together today. But as we always do, we'd love to have you offer a tip or a war story to kind of cap off our discussion.
Yeah, there's so many war stories. I'll tell you one that has very little to do with appellate practice, or at least outside of the big firm context, but I think you'll both appreciate it. I was sort of a doe-eyed summer associate at a very large international law firm. And I was working on a government investigations, a white-collar case, big document review intensive project. And the senior associate who was working on the document review needed just one of us on the team, one of the four associates, to come talk to him about something. And he says, are any of you available to come to my office right now and talk about something that's come up, some urgent document review related matter? And so I really quickly hit reply all so that the other people would know that they didn't need to come. And I responded, yah, and left, walked, you know, fancy, past the other white shoes to his office. And he's like in the same floor, but you know, you get around and walk in there and I sit down. And instead of giving me the document review assignment, he says, what in the blankety blank is wrong with you? This is not funny. I know you think it's funny. It's not funny. I was like, what are you talking about? I still think it was a software problem. But what in fact I had responded yah to was one of those emails, firm-wide emails at the global law firm that you only get at a global law firm, some very important partner asking for a referral to something extremely specific. Does anyone know? Can you recommend someone in Antwerp who has dealt with the intersection of European property rights law with Missouri's probate law? You know, and in the context of an International Trade Commission petition to remand back to The Hague, 11,000 lawyers worldwide got that email and immediately got my response, yah. So.
Spelled the redneck way.
Yes, exactly. Spelled the Arkansas way. Yeah. Okay. So I'm like fleeing at this point. You know what I mean? And you can imagine this was like in the BlackBerry days, right? Where I still get the phantom BlackBerry buzz. Your waist is just going crazy. It's just constantly buzzing with some hefty percentage of 11,000 lawyers worldwide replying that this is not typically the way that we would use the firm-wide email system. And I'm desperately hitting the unsend. You know what I mean? You know, I don't know what Outlook does today for unsend, but at least back then, all unsend did was send everybody a message that said, you know, Matthew Wright is trying to unsend the last message. So then there's 22,000 emails that I've burdened the global email system with. And shortly later, I joined the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Northern District.
The timing was purely coincidental.
Purely, I really love defendants and harm avoidance. So that's my war story.
That's a good one. Well, Matthew, thanks for spending the time with us. We really do appreciate your time and enjoyed visiting with you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.